Talk to us now and go to the TNT Radio Interactive live chat room at tntradio.live. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT. Trish Wood on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hi, everybody. Indeed, this is Trish Wood, and I'm back for hour two. And before we get to our wonderful guest, David Azarad, who's going to pick up somewhat thematically what we were hearing from Bruce Barty about, and that is we're stuck in this terrible spot, and the courts, which normally through invoking various clauses in the Charter of Rights, wherever you live, if you have one in Western country, should have been able to get us out of the COVID nightmare, and they weren't. So I think he laid out a pretty interesting case about why darkness is falling, has fallen. And so the other side of that coin is political. Right. So it's not just how do we solve these terrible policies once they happen, but maybe we should be electing people who won't invoke these terrible policies in the first place, who won't be running off to the World Economic Forum, who will say no to being part of this globalist leftist movement, which is ruining things for everybody, certainly ruining the lives of many, many people who don't want this. So David Azarad, who is an assistant prof at Hillsdale College, terribly smart. I saw him on Tucker Carlson. He did an hour with Tucker some time ago in that little studio that looks like a fishing cabin. I think it's in Maine. I learned once Tucker was fired that his studios are in Maine. I actually thought he was sitting in Washington, D.C., but no, it's not true. Tucker's smart. He builds studios where he's living. So I think he lives in Maine in the summer and Florida in the winter or something. What a great life. Anyway, David was totally brilliant, and he can address some of these larger political issues. He was born in Canada, in Montreal, and I believe he lives on the outskirts of Washington, D.C. now. And we're going to get to him in a minute. I just want to quickly talk to you about a story that's been breaking in various independent news media publications, Substack for one. And my friend Matt Strauss actually has a piece that he's also just recently published. And it's about the use of ventilators during COVID-19. This is very interesting. So Michael Singer's piece, which is Substack, he's a tax lawyer in California who did the best statistical research about COVID. I mean, he just became obsessed with it when he started questioning the narrative, and he did some wonderful research that all proved to be true. And he's written a piece, as has Dr. Strauss, about how, especially in New York City, you will recall those really terrifying scenes of freezer trucks pulling up and Potter's Field burials and, you know, weeping doctors, et cetera, et cetera. Everybody was hysterical. And everybody was hysterical because public health was making us hysterical, because the news media was pushing a fear narrative about COVID. So they had, in New York City, a fairly significant death rate. And looking back now, we know why that happened. And it had obviously something to do with COVID, but in a larger sense, it had to do with two things. Number one, Governor Cuomo was sending infected COVID patients back into long-term care, ground zero, for a fatal COVID infection, right? Those were the people dying. 80% of the cases were those people. So Cuomo, who actually, remember this, got an Emmy Award for his daily COVID briefings, he was sending infected patients back in there. I don't know why. I don't know what the thinking was. It was stupid, absurd, and somewhat murderous, if you ask me. So that was one reason that they were having these high numbers. But the other one was mechanical ventilations. You may recall, as I do, seeing a YouTube video of a young doctor named Cameron Kyle Sedell. This thing dropped, at least for critically thinking people, like a bombshell. And he sort of came in, he was still in his scrubs, he sits down, before the Cameron, he records a video saying, I think we're killing people with vents, essentially. He said it much more medically than that, but that was the gist of what he was saying. I don't think we should be ventilating. We got to stop ventilating patients. And I remember watching it. I saw it when I thought, wow, what's going on there? And so it emerged some time ago, but is really gaining strength now that we can talk about these things without being called terrible names. I mean, I always talked about it, but other people are weighing in. The idea that the vents actually had a very, very high death rate. 90% of the people in New York who went on ventilators died, right? And so it turns out that they were venting them too soon. And doctors have admitted, including a wonderful doctor from Louisiana, who told me personally that one of the reasons they were venting patients was because the staff was afraid of becoming infected. And it would keep the virus from being aerosolized and becoming more dangerous in the medical environment. So they were venting patients because they were scared and the vents were killing the patients. That's what happened. That's what we're looking at. All of these really terrible things that happened during COVID-19. It's called iatrogenic medicine. It's when medicine kills the patient. That's important, not just because it was a huge mistake driven by fear. They were demanding every day of Trump, get the ventilators and get the vent. Where are the ventilators? They were blaming Trump. We don't have enough ventilators. He was making Ford Motor Company or somebody retool their factories to make them. I mean, it was completely nuts and driven in part by the mainstream media. So now we're finally doing some archaeology on this craziness and finding out, yikes, those big numbers in New York City didn't have to happen, and they happened because of panic and fear driven by public health. So that is what I'm going to say about that. We're getting to David because I want to talk to David about politics and how we bail ourselves out of this terrible, terrible situation that we are in right now. So, David Azarad, are you there? It's Trish Wood.
I am. Thank you for having me, Trish.
Oh, happy to have you. As I said, I saw your interview with Tucker and was gobsmacked by it. You said so many smart things. And part of it was how we push back now. How can we grab a handle now that this kind of darkness has fallen, and I feel like we are less and less powerful as the days go by. What would you say to that?
Well, I think the prerequisite to pushing back is to not despair, is to reject, I don't know how online you are or the extent to which you follow how the kids speak, but the black pill, you know this one? You swallow the black pill of despair, you give up and you say, I'm going to move to Hungary or withdrawn to the woods with my ammo. And wait for the country to collapse. We're in bad shape. There are many worrisome trends. Yeah. There's every day the news brings new outrages. But the enemy we're confronting is just not that impressive. If you look at the ruthlessness of tyrants of the past, and you look at how, in a sense, pathetic the left is today, how unimpressive our elites are. They're not that smart. They're not that ruthless. They don't know pretty much anything about history. They're quite fragile. That doesn't mean that we are necessarily going to win, but I think the first thing that the right needs to do is to break out of the particle accelerator of despair and trauma, and it's all over, and kind of reground oneself into reality and see that there are many worrisome trends, but they're not that impressive. And when you couple that with the fact that there is more dissent in America today than in any regime in human history, it is easier to pierce through and undermine the lies of the government and of the media than in any other country that has ever existed. I know that the internet and Twitter are not as free as they once were, but they still remain extraordinarily powerful media for disseminating subversive information. And I mean subversive in the best sense of the term. I mean, you were talking in your opening segment about the COVID lies. Look at how much quote unquote disinformation has gone out on the racial hysteria, you know, the supposed claim that white police officers are shooting black Americans for sport. I mean, this just gets demolished every day on Twitter. So, yes, a lot of people do believe it with fanatical fervor. But I think we have a good enough shot if we stop despairing and if we just start fighting better. And this is a long overdue recalibration of the right that I think really started with Trump, but in a sense predates him. You know, there was a lot of Trump in Pat Buchanan. There was some Trump in Ross Perot. Trump is just the one who kind of pulled it off and got elected. You see now with, you know, what's the big split on the right? It's Trump and DeSantis. Both of them are very different kind of Republicans than the party has been used to be getting in the past 20, 30 years. This is ceasing to be the party of Mitt Romney and John McCain. Things are changing. Republicans are learning to govern, are becoming comfortable with the idea of using the levers of state power to defund and humiliate the institutional centers of powers of the left. So I don't have a turnkey solution for you. And I wouldn't say that I am gung-ho optimistic about the prospects, but I think that despair is utterly unwarranted.
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm kind of schizophrenic. I am a black pill on some days and fighting for optimism on the other. And the days I'm fighting for optimism are actually better days for me. But I do feel kind of blocked. And it is about, I'd love to hear you on this. Well, first of all, you said some amazing things. But one of the things you said to Tucker that I wanted you to explore here was that America is now anti-American, which is absolutely true. But I also want you to talk about what we are seeing with all of these American brands embracing this far left, ridiculous, absurd, dishonest trans ideology. What is going on there?
Okay, well, I'm glad you brought that up because I should have mentioned that. In a sense, this is nothing new, right? Corporations going woke and pushing woke propaganda down our throats is now a phenomenon that is, you know, several decades old in terms of being to the left of where America is. What's astounding in the past year is for the first time in my life, and that I know of, conservatives are mobilizing as consumers, which is something we had never done. We would mobilize as voters.
Yeah.
We would mobilize as activists to do a petition or organize a rally. But these corporations would, you know, basically crap on our values and support positions that we oppose, but we would continue to reward them with our consumer dollars. Bud Light and Target have both taken huge hits in the past week and month. And I find that very encouraging. Again, it's part of the right finally starting to do this long, long, long overdue course correction. And, you know, in a certain sense, starting to copy the left, which is do unto them what they do unto us. I mean, they've perfected, you know, the boycotts, the PR pressure campaigns. The using the levers of state power to direct money and honor and resources to allied institutions, investigating institutions they don't like. So the fact that the corporations are woke to me is not cause for despair. The fact that the right is finally doing something about it is cause for some optimism because I put it to you this way, Trish, the reason we can't give up is that we haven't really tried. I would give up on America if we had really given it our best shot and been completely overwhelmed by the other side. And then you're like, well, listen, what else is there to do? Let's just bend the knee and resign ourselves to living under a woke tyranny. But we haven't. Look at what a pathetic sight the Republican Party has been on the whole, right? What's their big thing? Tax cuts for corporations that support open borders and are pushing woke issues down.
Yeah.
Finally, now the party's starting to wake up. So I want to, I feel that we are, everything is leading up to the moment where we're finally going to have a fight, which we haven't really had a fight. You know, Mitt Romney and John McCain are not representative of the base. They are people who would care more about what the New York Times said about them than what Republican voters thought about them. Finally, this is being cleared out. And once we have the real fight, then let's reconvene if you want, and maybe you can have me on your show another time, and then we can see how it went. But we haven't really been fighting.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, in Canada, it's really bad. I mean, I don't, the media here is so aligned with the Liberal Party and also with the NDP that, like, we don't have a Fox News up here. We have, you know, we have Rebel News. They're small but growing. We have True North. They're really trying and doing some good stuff. But we don't have a conservative, if that's the right word even anymore, but let's use it, a conservative broadcast organ. I mean, even England has GB News, right, which is quite good, right? But we don't have anything like that here. So I do despair, and partly I despair because of the reaction by the other side to the truckers here and January 6th there. I'm not exactly comparing them. I know there was some violence in when January 6th happened, none with the truckers. But what those two events have in common is that they were populist, and they made people feel, after watching the BLM riots, which actually were super violent and cities were on fire, and then they go and try to have a protest and they're shut down and it's an insurrection and everybody goes to jail or their trucks are seized as they were here. Those are things that are very debilitating. And I also think that the grabbing of the bank accounts here too, the use of kind of financial punishment as a remedy to legitimate protest really, really frightened people here. So I don't know if people are kind of up to pushing back, or maybe they're too demoralized.
So yeah, look, Canada is in worse shape than the US. You mentioned the absence of conservative, or maybe we could just say populist, media outlets.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah,
I would add, why is it that Canada is the only major Western country that doesn't have a right-wing populist politician of any kind of clout and following? Where is the Salvini? Where is the Orban? Where is the Trump? Where is the DeSantis? Where is the Zemmour? It's kind of astounding. Why has no one tapped into the dissatisfaction with wokeness, with globalism, with excessive immigration? Now, that being said, Canada is not dead because, you know, you mentioned the trucker protest. So there's two ways to look at the trucker protest. On the one hand, it really shows you the very heavy hand of government, the seizure,
yes,
of their funds. On the other hand, it shows that Canada, which at times seems to be the most docile Western country when it comes to that. I mean, that Justin Trudeau remains popular with voters. It's utterly astounding.
I can't even, David.
But on the other hand, Canada's not dead because the truckers were there. You know, Friedrich Nietzsche, yeah, the great German philosopher, had a very powerful image in his book, Thus Spoke Zarathustra. He worried that we were tending towards what he called the last man, which is kind of like a sheep-like creature who's barely human anymore, just lives for his belly and goes along with whatever he is told to do. And there's a line in there where Nietzsche says, those who think otherwise voluntarily go into the madhouse, i.e., if you really had last men, there would be absolutely no protest, because those who disagreed with the official edicts of the state would voluntarily check themselves in. Well, my message of hope for Canada is they're not last men yet because there were the truckers. And
yeah, and that's how we felt. We all loved them.
Yeah, I don't feel it's so far-fetched to think that if some sort of a populist leader were to arise, maybe in Quebec or maybe out in the prairies, and could get some sort of an online media backing, you could see a movement gain steam. But yeah, for the time being, I will say Canada is, it is discouraging to see how little resistance there is.
Well,
how no one wants to tap into what is, there is clearly some popular discontent with the regime, but no one is galvanizing it or tapping into it or mobilizing it.
Well, I will say, we got to go to a break. I will say that Maxime Bernier tried, but the media is so manipulative about anybody speaking up in a populist way in this country. Automatically, they're whites, they're this, they're, you know, the usual stuff they say, right? So it's been very difficult for him. He's never been given a fair shake. Let's talk more about that in a minute when we come back from break. Back in a mo. Trish Wood here.
TNT Radio's Katie Hopkins.
Dominic Raab, he has joined the massive list of people who are standing down at the next election. The list is long now. So it was 36, we're now up to 37. 37 Conservative MPs, unless it's gone up again overnight, and loads of them are young ones. Loads of them are ones that should have been in politics for the next 10, 20 years. Loads of them are at the age where they should be just reaching their heights of power. So Dominic Raab, how old is he? I'm wanting to say he's less than 50. Let me tell you, 36, 37 standing down. Just looking at the ages here, 53, 51, Rob Walker, 44, Edward Timpson, 49. These are young people that should be just really striding into their seats, given they have political power, and yet they are running away. They know what's coming up the next election. They know what's going to happen to the Conservative Party. They probably know what's going to happen to the country very soon, and they are running for cover like rats off a sinking ship. And I think the rats should be made to stay on the ship.
Katie Hopkins on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
In many countries around the world, medical care is scarce. From birth defects to serious injuries and illnesses, countless millions have no access to safe surgery. Mercy Ships is there to help. With a team of volunteer professionals, nurses, surgeons, utilizing state-of-the-art hospital ships, Mercy Ships provides free surgeries for the thousands of those who are waiting for surgery at each port.
Mercy Ships is bringing services to countries that would otherwise never be able to access those services.
We just see people that need help. You realize that they have no way of getting help, and I want them to know that they're loved.
Help make a lasting impact and turn someone's fear to joy. Find out how you can help by visiting our website at mercyships.org for more information. That's mercyships.org.
It sounds pretty good.
It sounds real, dude.
Not bad, huh?
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hi, everybody. Trish Wood here. Yeah, Mercy Ships is a very, very worthy cause. I know something about them, and they do incredible work. David, I want to talk to you about the DeSantis Trump feud, if it's actually real or not. What do you make of it?
I mean, had you told me 10 years ago that the two leading candidates for the Republican Party nomination, I mean, I wouldn't, you know, forget their names, but what they stood for, you know, basically how out of sync they would largely be with establishment Republicanism, the extent to which they would be closer, say, to Pat Buchanan than to George W. Bush, I don't think I would have believed you. So, you know, there are arguments in favor of each one. They each have strengths and weaknesses. I'm more encouraged by the fact that there's an overlap, the two of them, and basically a core agreement on a more muscular, aggressive approach to fighting the culture wars and to being more dismissive of the media and its echo chamber. My hope is that the primary is not too brutal and nasty, because at the end of the day, I think they're both broadly in the same camp. But the nature of primaries is, you know, it gets nasty, and we all know how Trump fights. But
yes, dirty. Yeah.
Regardless of who ends up getting the nomination, I think it's a win for the Republican base and for America, and not necessarily for the Republican establishment, though.
Well, I will just say this, because I say what's on my mind, and that is they got to get the Democrats out of D.C. I mean, look it. Joe Biden is demented. That is absolutely clear. He has no idea what he's doing. The agenda that he is carrying out is actually anti-American. It's hurting the country. And what is grotesque about it is that instead of the party saying, well, we got a problem with this guy, we got to mitigate the damage he's doing, they are supporting it so that they can hang on to power. They will completely sell the country down the river in order to cement their power. And that's, to me, unthinkable. I mean, he is an embarrassment. She is laughing his head off, I am sure. And, you know, and not... And well, I mean, it's just, I mean, he's just an embarrassment. I mean, and I'm sure that Putin is, you know, obviously he's mad about American support for Ukraine in a war that should have been over, you know, a year ago when people wanted to sort of have a negotiated settlement. But I just think the Democrats are the root of all evil. And it's not hyperbole for me right now. It's not just it's beyond politics. They are hurting the people. They are hurting the average American person, and someone has got to stop it. And I don't think, as you so brilliantly said, that it's the old school wing of the GOP. They don't care. They just want what they get, and it's kind of a uniparty. And Bob's your uncle. So the people they, you know, Biden's always saying MAGA Republicans, like it's the worst thing in the world. I actually think MAGA is the only way to go right now. I think if you're not voting for a MAGA Republican, there's something wrong with you.
Yeah, I got to correct your statement. I don't know that the Democrats are the root of all evil. I would probably say that intellectuals are the root of all evil. Because you got to make for the media and of course above all for the universities. You know, look, the Democratic Party and the left, you know, they can afford to have a vegetable in the White House because they control the deep state. They control the authoritative opinion-shaping institutions in America, the universities, the media. We on the right are much more dependent on extraordinary, charismatic, strong leaders, you know, people like Tucker Carlson, like Donald Trump, like Ron DeSantis, because we have so little institutional power. Once you've completed the revolution, which the left has, taking over the country, ensconced yourself everywhere, the thing kind of runs on autopilot. If anything, you know, Biden's obvious cognitive decline and partial incapacity reveals the extent to which the president is a figurehead and that the power is scattered in the different nodes of the regime. And that, you know, they just put him up there, give him his talking points to read, and he reads them. You can't do that if you're on the dissident right. You can't do that if you're on the populist right, because you're trying to, you know, drain the swamp, as Trump put it, or take on the whole establishment, the corporate sector, the bureaucracy, the media, the universities, the public sector unions. And that requires, this is why we're so, you know, Tucker's defenestration at Fox News is such a tragic loss for the right. Because he's irreplaceable. Whereas, think of it this way. Who would you get rid of, media-wise, on the left that would deal a comparable blow to them? No one. They don't need a Tucker because they just have interchangeable talk show hosts that just kind of all sound the same and are all reading from the same script. We are much more dependent on these extraordinary figures.
Yeah, I agree with you about Tucker. I think it was a huge huge loss. And I, you know, even I we used to watch him in my household, 8 o'clock. It was sacred time. Tucker's on. I didn't always watch all the way through if I didn't like his content that night. I had things to do, but it was kind of a ritual because he says things that are informed by history and that helped. It actually helped me sort out some things because I come from the left. I was a left until 2015, 2016. I was a lefty. And then I kind of became something else. I say this on the show all the time. Nobody can believe it, but I was a Bernie supporter, and it was because I'm very kind of emotionally attached to supporting working people. But it was the corruption around the primary, the fakery of Bernie giving to Hillary. And then for me, the key of it was I never had a problem with Trump, even while I was supporting Bernie. I thought Trump was quite entertaining. And I wrote a book about the Iraq War, and I had an experience with Trump about the Iraq War many, many years ago. And he actually is against regime change wars. He had a very sophisticated mm-hmm. and well thought out policy about it. And so I knew, I agree with what he was saying about trade and the factories going to China and all that stuff. Like I thought, oh, this guy's kind of Bernie, but not Bernie, right? It was interesting. And then when I really tipped over the edge, David, was watching the Russia hoax. I'm a longtime investigative journalist. I knew it was BS. And so watching this hoax, the Russia hoax, unfold as a way to hobble a duly elected American president was nauseating for me. And I don't know if you've read it, but I just interviewed Jeff Girth, who wrote the big Columbia Journalism Review takedown of the American media during the Russia collusion story. And it's flabbergasting that it happened. And that profoundly changed my DNA. And I am now, whatever I am, I say a Woody Guthrie libertarian, which is probably silly, but I am a kind of a populist now. That's what I am. And Tucker kind of drew the outline of that for me when he said, oh, the GOP yeah. are no good either. It's a uniparty. They're all creeps. And McKinsey did it. And this is what, you know, and I thought, okay, I get it now, you know? And so, and I thought all conservatives were pro-war. I thought they were all neocons, you know? So I think maybe that's why he's dangerous, because people really trust his analysis, don't they?
Yeah. And the other thing, I mean, you know, Tucker is also very intelligent. I don't know if you've ever read any of his essays or you read his last book, Ship of Fools. I mean, he's got a clear mind. He's not just a television personality. He's an intelligent guy. He downplays it all the time. He loves to say, you know, I'm just a talk show host. I don't know anything. The other thing he has that I think is perhaps his most underappreciated strength is his irreverence and that laugh. And this is really what draws the ruling class and the left in particular, that is so completely humorless, so humorless, is to see that their pieties don't have a hold on his mind, that he laughs in their faces. And you can't do that before fanatics. Fanatics don't allow laughter. You see it on, you know, if you're hysterical about climate change, if you're hysterical about religion, if you're hysterical about wokeness, you're humorless. And I think it was so important to show Americans that you could have someone on national television laughing in their faces. And when the predictable outrage would erupt, not apologizing, not bowing down, this is why I think he drove them so angry. They can tolerate controlled opposition, like the court eunuchs, you know, who just are slightly to the right of Democratic Party and elite class talking points. But what they can't tolerate, well, basically is a free man. And Tucker was, and I think remains, a free man. And I'm hopeful and curious to see what he's going to do next. But I think he is irreplaceable and invaluable on the right.
Yeah, I agree with you. And what told me he was a free man was that on the day after the news broke and everybody was so devastated, there was a shot of him and his lovely wife, Susan, who he's known since high school. And I've never heard a story about anybody in that marriage misbehaving. And they sleep with three or four dogs on the bed. So these are people I totally relate to, right? And I saw them driving around their neighborhood in Florida on a golf cart going to dinner. And he was laughing his head off in with the cackle, you know, with the Tucker Carlson cackle. Yeah. And I thought, this guy, he's fine. These are happy people. He's living his life as an honest man. He bows down to no one. He says, pronouns are stupid. That is stupid. I'm not doing this. You can't, I'm not racist. Don't be like all the things that we should be saying. He says it and it makes you a free person, although he has certainly suffered the slings and arrows from Media Matters and the rest of them. But that was also a big thing to see him being happy, because I thought, oh God, we've lost him too. You know, I was like, oh,
if I can make a slightly more provocative point, building on what you just said, it's also the fact that he's a straight white Christian man who's healthy and happy, and that they don't like. Yeah. The regime will tolerate straight white cis men, but only if they're neutered and housebroken. You know, if they go to the DEI training and announce their pronouns. Yeah. It's the defiance and, you know, that drives them crazy. You know, look, he's one of the last wasps standing, if you want, who hasn't been broken. I mean, at that level of prominence. I mean, there are plenty more, of course, but I mean, in our public life, who isn't apologizing constantly, who's, you know, a self-confident, happy, patriotic man, that's what they can't tolerate.
Yeah. Well, and he's from an aristocratic family from California too. So that's, it's just, he's just a very, very interesting cat. And I do worry about if the show is actually going on Twitter. And My concern about it is this, that I feel that Tucker's audience is primarily old, not all old, but maybe over the age of 40. And I worry that they are not used to interacting with him on that kind of a platform. I think this could be a problem. I don't know what the solution is. But anyway, let's talk about that in a minute. I got to go to break and we'll be back in a moment with David Azarad.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
The UK Met folks have put out their hurricane forecast, and a lot of people are looking at that, and it raised a lot of eyebrows because they have a season that is the equivalent of 2017 in the Atlantic Basin. I mean, we all know that was one heck of a year, right? What's fascinating to me is, and I don't think any hurricane forecast is laughable this year, or I would never criticize it. And so I don't want you to think this is criticism, because UK Met has done a good job with hurricane forecasting, is that the forecasted 200 to 850 millibar shear is exactly opposite of 2017 and actually implies that no. It's going to be a normal to below normal season, which is what Weather Bell has had. Now, there's a lot of scuttlebutt about the El Nino. First line of the Weather Bell February hurricane forecast is an El Nino's coming. Didn't bat an eyelash. This is a bounce back response to 3 years of La Nina, and we have a lot of oceanic warming at the bottom of the ocean. So what do you think is going to happen when that La Nina comes off? Boom, it's coming up. And plus, we don't know what's going on with the underwater volcanic activity, especially off South America, which was linked to the strength of the 2015 El Nino. See what I'm saying? Now, speaking of England and the UK, last week they were forecasting a heat wave for this week. You having a heat wave over there, folks? The weather's actually nice over there, right? Well, now they're trying for a heat wave again. And the highest temperature on the European generated model and the US models, which go out 10 to 15 days in London, is 24°C. Now, is this a heat wave now? 24°C? There's going to be a heat wave in France, but France is not part of the UK. The UK had Brexit, so I don't think UK is part of France, right? See, I know my geography. And I know that you should enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you got. This is TNT Climate and Weather Watchdog meteorologist Joe Bastardi.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
In a March 19 executive order, President Zelensky invoked martial law to ban 11 opposition parties. The outlawed parties consisted of the entire left-wing socialists or anti-NATO parties in Ukraine, openly fascist and pro-Nazi parties like the Azov National Corps were unaffected by the presidential decree. President Zelensky ordered an unprecedented domestic propaganda initiative to nationalize all television news broadcasting and combine all channels into a single 24-hour channel called United News to tell the truth about war. On April 12th, President Zelensky announced the arrest of his main political rival, Viktor Medvedchuk, by the SBU security services.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT, with Trish Wood.
Yeah, I'm back with David Azarad. I want to talk about reparations because it's kind of looking like it might happen, which is it's such an interesting subject because the Democrats keep winning. They don't do anything for inner city blacks ever. South and West Side Chicago are still a nightmare of shooting and kind of a lost culture and kids who barely even speak the English language. And it's just like a horror show. Many other cities like that too. The Dems never do anything for them while Al Sharpton gets rich, causing racial tension. I mean, it's just astonishing. So is writing checks to people the solution to these deeply, deeply entrenched problems in your view? I'm not saying maybe there is a debt to be paid. I don't know how it gets paid, if in fact we all agree that there is a debt to be paid. But it looks like this is going to happen, and I feel it could be a kind of a disaster.
So, Trish, I'm about as right-wing as it gets. I would support reparations for Black Americans, but on one condition. If we pass reparations, everyone agrees that we're done with the racial guilt, obsessing over the past, making excuses for Black people, and we basically leave the whole thing behind. Meaning, we treat Black people the way we treat everyone else. We are polite to one another in our everyday dealings. We expect the government to equally enforce laws against all, and we generally don't discriminate in the private sector. If I were to, I would be willing to put Ta-Nehisi Coates, Ibram X. Kendi, Al Sharpton, you name it, Jesse Jackson, I don't know if he's dead, all of them, they get to pick the amount. I say at this point, what's a few extra trillion dollars? The thing is, they would never consent to such a deal, or rather they would, but then they would they'd immediately go back to racial guilt and haranguing because it is the left's most powerful asset is that they occupy the moral high ground in America on all debates because by definition, they've anointed themselves the party that's not racist. And the accusation of racism in America today and in Canada and in the West is the most serious one you can level at a person to utterly discredit them. You know, it would be the equivalent of calling someone an atheist in the Middle Ages. Or maybe a communist in McCarthyite America. And so they are never, ever going to give up the baseless accusation of racism. And what the right needs to realize is no amount of goodwill, of reparations, of school choice, of Juneteenth celebrations, of MLK monuments on the mall are ever going to get the professionally aggrieved Black class and the Democratic Party and the left to relent on wokeness. Their whole worldview is premised on the idea that they are anti-racists who are fighting the fascists on the right. And when the supply of racism is just not there, the way it has been declining in America for the past decades, they just need to make it up. They just need to redefine racism down to find it where it doesn't exist. So, you know, I understand why they're asking for reparations. What I can't countenance is that anyone on our side would think that any kind of goodwill in this regard would be rewarded. I think the only approach to dealing with these, you know, racial hijackers and terrorists is zero tolerance, a clean conscience. You know, bad things happen. It was a long time ago. Refuse to cede to the guilt. And you mentioned the fact that the Democratic Party does not do much for Black America. You know, I think the basic message at this point is, when is Black America going to start doing something for itself?
Well, I agree with that. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a really interesting question. But just to not be too theoretical about it, I did see Thomas Sowell talking a clip. And he said, I'm not in any way denigrating the horror of slavery in America. I understand that. I mean, as much as I can, given who I am and where I live. But other cultures and other countries also had slave economies, including the Barbary Coast, who enslaved white people, right? Like, it's kind of like, this isn't a problem that's particularly in the DNA of America, and other places were not demanding reparations from them. I mean, I just feel like it isn't going to move anybody forward. That, like, for instance, this case right now in New York of this Marine who choke held a chap who died, who'd been apparently threatening people on the subway. And the case was reviewed, and the people in the DA's office said no, and it was over, and then they took over the subway. And it's kind of the usual suspects, right? In the subway, and Al Sharpton is yapping about how it was murder and stuff. I don't think for a minute that this guy did it intentionally. There's no evidence for that. That's
he
not
was being
gonna
filmed.
End if they pick.
Fish. He was yeah. he was being filmed. Yeah. Who commits murder in front of a camera? It's absurd.
Yeah. So are they, you know, is that going to end this? No, it's not going to end it. It's just going to, you know, I'd rather see the money go to that than to Ukraine, which is a big losing disaster. But I don't know what it's supposed to do.
Is neither
one an
option? It
doesn't wipe the stain clean.
Is what? Neither one an option, Trish? Can it be neither Ukraine nor reparations? Is that an option?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, my baseline, and maybe I'm old fashioned, is that people of goodwill, you know, yes, there is racism. Yes, there is. But the vast majority of people of goodwill, and America is a country about fairness, or it was until all this stuff started, the woke stuff started happening. I just don't think that it's a problem that needs to be resolved in a way as significant as this. And I fear it's just going to make things worse. That's my intuition about it.
I think you mentioned that, you know, America is not unique in having committed injustices in the past. I think what makes America and the West different than pretty much any other civilization that I can think of is, on the one hand, acknowledging and apologizing for the past injustices, the Holocaust, yes, slavery, colonialism, Jim Crow, I mean, you name it. Japan, does Japan seem to be racked with war guilt over what they did to China? As best as I can tell, no. This is a uniquely
Western.
Yeah,
not really. Yeah.
Yeah. Are the Arabs racked with guilt for their role in the slave trade on the east coast of Africa? Not that I can tell. So in a sense, this is good because the West holds itself up to standards of justice and says, we committed unjust acts and this was wrong. The problem is the pathologization of guilt and victimhood, the fetishization of these things, refusing to go beyond the past sins. You know, in America, they've started referring to slavery as original sin. And I always tell my students, that's a pretty interesting term they've chosen because that's a Christian theological term. It's not a political term, but with one big difference. Christianity has a solution to the problem of original sin. It's salvation through Jesus Christ. Wokeness has the original sin of slavery, but no promise of redemption, no hope of salvation. It's self-flagellation, reparations, affirmative action, set aside preferential treatment from here until eternity.
Well, and that's racist. And one of the things that happened last week, I'd love to get you to opine on, is the idea that, you know, I do believe that some of these ideas in themselves are racist. And one of them is what happened with Black Lives Matter, which I think has kind of imploded. Super bad financial managing of the massive amounts of funds they had, and maybe a bit of grifty stuff going on too, overpaying relatives and buying mansions and that sort of stuff. And it didn't get a lot of attention in the legacy media. And I thought that in and of itself was racist. If it was not an organization run by Black women, wouldn't they be being more public and more scrutinized about what they were doing? But there's this thing, oh, well, you know, Black people can't run NGOs, so we're just going to, I mean, it was ridiculous. Of course they should be held to account for it. And if there was criminal activity involved, they should be held to account for that too. But that's not the way people are treating it. It's like, oh, it was such a good organization and this is really sad. And those poor people, you know, it's just, it's kind of infantilizing, isn't it?
Yes. And the fundamental lie of wokeness, of anti-racism, is that it is opposed to racism. And that's just not true. It is only opposed, it is only opposed to white racism against non-whites. I mean, I don't need to tell you how hate crimes committed by Blacks against Jews or whites get a pass in the media, or against Asians. No one cares about that. The only racism that the woke care about is white racism against non-whites. And then the other fact of it, you know, which really explains the core phenomenon, is that it just is not, wokeness and anti-racism are not committed to equality and color blindness as normal people understand it. It really is committed to sacralizing people of color, and Blacks always come first in the hierarchy of the oppressed, hence the term BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, and people of color, to give them pride of first place, and to demonizing whiteness. And, you know, I hear myself say these things. I think we all get uncomfortable talking this way because we're like, well, what are you talking about? Like, you're starting to sound like a white nationalist. And I think that's absurd. We just need to develop the courage to call a spade a spade. The woke movement, the media and the left are anti-white. They don't really mask it. And we should be comfortable calling it out. Period.
Well, I think that's the message, that we have to be comfortable calling everything out. And the way that they win, and this is how Media Matters got so powerful, and they are powerful. What's his name? Sidney Blumenthal, I think, was the person who started, used to work for Hillary Clinton. This was an offshoot of the Clinton arm of the Democratic Party. And they're so powerful now. They know exactly what they're doing. They cut clips and they say, oh, this is racist and this is that and this is that. And then the legacy media picks it up and amplifies it. I mean, and then they send it off to advertisers. I mean, it's a really crazy, wicked, smart way of silencing your critics. But we, you know, I feel like we, and when I say we, I mean people who aren't that, not just on the right, but people who are maybe even more centrist than what's happening on the left these days, we're not good at that. And I think it's because, in a sense, they're street fighting and maybe everybody else is just too polite. Like, some of the things they do are so disgusting that, I don't know, do you have to fight that way in order to win the day in political circles now?
I do think there is a lot we should learn to do from the left that we should emulate. With limits, you know, for example, when they go attack people, public figures who are dining with their families in restaurants, like they did to Tucker Carlson, for example, I think that's completely unacceptable. I think that if Rachel Maddow or Nancy Pelosi are having dinner out at a restaurant, you don't go bother them. That being said, you know, the boycotts, the protests, the, like I said, once you're in power, defunding and investigating their institutions, like all the DEI stuff at the universities, like I found it, I'm always baffled by the fact that we have 20 plus states in America that are in full Republican control, both houses of the legislature and the governor, and cuts are never made to the public universities, which are you know, the home of the left. Why doesn't a red state governor just say we're defunding all sociology departments at public universities in our state? If you want to study sociology, you want to study sociology, go to a private university. We're not forbidding the teaching of it. Why are our tax dollars going to subsidize this left-wing garbage? The public, the private sector doesn't want it. No one is saying, oh, we need better trained sociologists.
Yeah, amazing. And I didn't even get a chance to talk to you about Vivek Ramaswamy, and I want to. So I'm going to have you back really, really soon. Thanks so much for doing this, David. And God bless Hillsdale College. They're doing really important things. We'll see you next time.
Thank you, Trish.
I'm Trish. Thank you very much. I'm Trish Wood of Trish Wood is Critical Podcast and TNT Radio. My website is trishwoodpodcast.com and my Twitter is @WoodReporting. Come and see me there and do come back and see me again next week. See ya.